This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, fascinating characters and biggest brains in sport. Judy Murray knows a thing or two about the benefits of sport for kids. Her sons Jamie and Andy have at various times been world number ones and Grand Slam tennis champions. But in part two of When Orla Met Judy Murray, I'm curious to hear how she thinks sport can be used in a more general way to make children and young people more rounded and developed. I want to learn in particular about her mission to get girls into sport. Why do we still need that focused push? And as a woman who's had to buck a very male tennis system over the years, where does she see feminism today and her role in it? I'm hugely grateful to Twist Teas for supporting this podcast. I'm exploring their mint options at the minute and loving their After Eight and Mint Humbug blends, chocolate and toffee with mint and tea. What is not to love? So brew yourself a cup of Twist Teas and enjoy part two of When Orla Met Judy Murray. So is that love of the torture side of it, is that something that you can learn, do you think? Or is that something that is deeply ingrained in someone? Where does that come from? Because there is a darkness to all the winning, isn't there? There's a lot of suffering involved in it. There's an awful lot of mental torture. Where do you get the resilience to be able to deal with all of that? Is that something you're born with, do you think?
I don't know. I think you can debate that all sorts of different ways. You know, everybody is different, but I always go back to this thing: we are products of our environment, and so, you know, it is up to the parents to introduce kids, allow them to go through the school of hard knocks, you help them to get up again, but, you know, at the end of the day, you can't solve all their problems for them, you can't do things for them. I mean, I look at my kids out on the tennis court playing in front of millions of thousands of people, but millions of TV viewers and everything, and they're on their own, more or less. Jamie obviously has a partner, but Andy's out there on his own, and you have to develop, you know, independent, problem-solving, resilient warriors, and you have to let life do that. Doesn't just happen on the tennis court. I think that's one of the things that worries me about this whole, you know, school sports now, so much is just participation based. Life isn't like that. Life is a competition. You know, it's a competition. It's a competition going for a job, you know, or a job interview and so forth. So I do think kids are so much more protected nowadays. And we have to be careful that isn't really preparing them for what adult life is likely to throw at them.
So do you think that we should be allowing our kids to win and lose, to learn what it's like to lose, and not just, I mean, there is an element of needing children to be able to enjoy sport, but at the same time, you think that they need to be able to learn to lose and that there are going to be winners and it's not always going to be them.
Yeah, definitely. And again, you know, kids rely on parents to teach them, you know, all sorts of things and to handle all sorts of things. So, you know, I've always felt that in life you learn much more from the defeats, the losses, the disappointments than you do from the wins and things, you know. And I always saw that when the boys were doing their tennis as kids, that whenever they were old enough to actually understand the game well, that whenever they lost was a much bigger opportunity for them to learn about what they needed to work on to improve. And I always saw it as that. So it was never about you lost, I'm in a bad mood driving the car home because you've lost. But for some parents it is. They just see win and loss. And I would always think it's an opportunity for when they're ready to talk about it, to ask them why they maybe thought they lost and what would they like to work on, what can I help you with? If you were playing that guy again tomorrow, what would you want to be able to do better? And you tease it out of them, and then what you've actually done is you've provided the next training session. But it's them that's told you. It's not about what I see or what I know or me telling you it. It's actually, what can I tease out of you, you know, to help you to improve. And it's kind of still like that. I mean, I was one of the first coaches in tennis to be using video analysis. Now it's a really common thing, but we took a video analyst with us to the US Open juniors in 2004. The Scottish Institute of Sport gave us somebody, you know, for the week and paid their expenses to come out. And it was like gold dust to me because I got her to video the next opponent and the next opponent. So then we go and I would study it. I would prepare a 10 or 15 minute, here's the tactics and whatever. What do you see? What do you think here? And I knew what I wanted to say, but by pulling the clips out, I could just, what do you see here? Do you see how he moved to that ball? What would you do next? I've just always seen that as being an opportunity to help them to learn and to understand and to own what it is that, you know, that they're doing. But I do think that nowadays life isn't creating the hard knocks for kids. You know, you don't see them playing freely out in the street or out in the park or down the tennis club the way that they used to. Kids are programmed into activity from a young age. Maybe that has a lot to do with both parents working, more money, less time. They pay other people to do things with their kids. Maybe it's just the whole child protection issues of kids don't go out on their own so much. They don't walk to school as much. They get driven. The world has changed so much, but we do have to, I think we do have a duty as parents and teachers to prepare them for, you know, the tough stuff as well as the good stuff.
You mentioned the psychology of winning and the importance of what goes on between your ears as much as how your body performs. And I noticed that you retweeted a quote of Sir Alex Ferguson's a little while back in which he said, given a player with a lot of talent but perhaps lacking in determination compared with someone who's good but is determined to succeed, he would always take the latter. Do you think that your mentality is more important to get to the top than your ability? And do you think that applies beyond sport?
Yes, I think you need to have both, but actually the ability to work hard day in and day out is a talent in itself. But I've seen many gifted, skillful young athletes or players who don't have the right mentality or the right attitude, and you know it's going to be hard to get them to work hard enough to maximize the talent and the potential. And I think the more years that I've been involved in coaching, the more I understand how important it is to know what surrounds the player in terms of the home environment, because you as the coach will have very limited access to that player or that athlete compared to what the parents or the siblings have. And if you are constantly talking about how hard you have to work, the hours that you have to put in, the effort levels, the attitude, etc., if that's not being backed up at home, if they're going home and mum or dad is saying, oh, golden child, you're fantastic, you don't need to, yeah, you can sleep longer, you don't need to do that, I'll get your bag ready for you, I'll do everything for you, or you're going to be great, you don't need to work hard, don't worry about it, you know that's not helping. You need everything. It's that, what they call it, the parent coach triangle, parent coach player. And it's really important that the coaches engage with the parents to help the parents understand how they can help to influence what's required within the sport. And it can be really simple things like, you know, the mum or the dad always packs the bag for them to go, so the child never knows what tension their racket is strung at, because their mum always gets it strung. Or I don't know what size of shoes I take because my mum always gets them. Or it's all of this kind of thing. And making them go to the supermarket and pick out their own snacks and read what's on the snacks, what's good in this, what's not good in it, what do you need to have in your bag, make them pack their bags, make them carry them bags themselves. You see parents carrying the bags and you get, I think, no. I suppose it's because I understand so well what sport, or tennis in particular, is going to demand of the child. And we need independent, responsible, strong problem solvers that are able to think for themselves. And at the end of the day, they've got to be doing the sport because they love it and they want to do it. And sometimes we just make life too easy for them.
And those lessons that you're talking about teaching your children, they seem to be lessons that extend way beyond sport, that are crucial for any child to learn to be a responsible, self-sufficient, functioning human. Do you think that we appreciate enough just how important sport can be, or how useful sport can be in teaching those lessons?
Probably not, because I think if you look at the sport offering in most state schools now, it's nowhere near enough physical activity in a week, and that linked to the sort of the whole protectiveness around kids, not as many kids walking to school, they get lifts everywhere, programmed activity, not as much free play. I think that, and the fact that the things that have been trendy for some years for kids to play with tend to be sit in front of a screen and twiddle your thumbs. And so that has led to more overweight children, less coordinated children, and neither of those things are conducive to sport. But I think that if we could get more people in influential positions, probably in the government, to understand the importance of physical literacy, that it is every bit as important as reading and writing, and to invest more into creating more activity, it doesn't have to be sport. I think it's about getting people active. And nowadays, if you look at all the things that are opportunities for kids to do that are exercise related, but not necessarily sport, with dance and music in particular, these are a great way to get people exercising and active. And of course, if you start to love exercising at a young age, it's likely to stay with you. But even if you start out enjoying, I don't know, Zumba or some kind of aerobics at school, that might then lead you to going to try a sport. But I think the traditional sports are up against so many other things, competing with so many other things for kids' time, that unless they're fun and taught well and stimulating, you're going to lose kids to the screens or to other things. But sport in itself, so many things that you can learn from it, discipline, routine, communication, organization, leadership skills, problem solving, resilience, teamwork. These are all things that you need later on in life. So for me, I think, if I was a minister for sport, I would be having a whole lot more physical activity in schools, and I would be opening up schools after hours for sporting activity, and I would have a whole lot more school teams, because I think that whole thing of working as a team and sense of belonging is critical for kids, and also far more likely to prepare you for later in life and for the workplace further down the line.
Maybe you should be sports minister. Would you consider that?
I think I've got enough on my plate.
And one thing that you do have on your plate, you're so active and passionate about getting girls into tennis, and I guess extension girls into sport. Why do we still need to be encouraging and supporting girls in particular to get into sport? Why have we not solved that problem already, do you think?
I think for some of the reasons that I just spoke about there, I think for me it doesn't have to be sport. I think music and dance are huge things in girls' lives now, and I think that girls tend to be not as competitive as boys. They tend to be not as physical, not as noisy, generally. But the big thing for girls is they like to be with their friends. So I think that creating activity, team sports, I think, have got a big advantage over individual sports, because there's bigger numbers of them and they're all working together. But I think we need to have options in school that are not the traditional sports, so all the Zumbas, cheerleadings, contemporary dance, street dance, all of these, they're great for teamwork, rhythm and timing, coordination skills and so forth. But I do think we need to give girls what they want. And if you look at Girls Worlds now, where appearance, image conscious, body conscious, it kicks in much younger than it ever used to. You know, it probably kicks in around 11 and 12 now, where maybe it used to be 14, 15. And that's just because of the way of the world. They're so influenced by what they see on TV and what they're reading in magazines. So even simple things like, you know, for some girls to go and do, I don't know, cross country in the rain, and their makeup runs and their hair gets wet and they don't have enough time to get ready for their next class, can be a really traumatic thing. And that might sound a bit excessive, but if you put yourself into a girl's world, we actually need to solve some of these problems. So maybe physical activity or dance or whatever it is becomes a double period, and there are more sockets in the changing room for your hair dryer and your hair straightener, and you have a little bit of extra time to get yourself ready to go to your class, so that it's not, well, I hate sport, I don't want to do it because I look like a shambles afterwards and that's a major thing for me. It's actually, well, that's fine, I do my 40 minutes of my dance class, then I've got time to have a shower, wash my hair and get ready, put my face on and go back, because that's the reality of a girl's world now. So I think we need more female PE teachers, we need more women creating the environment, because they understand what girls want. It's a big thing that I have in sport, about having that all the key decision makers in most sports tend to be men, and men will not think and act on behalf of women because they are not women. So we need to have more decision makers who are women. So therefore, we need to invest in a career pathway for women through sports, so that we get more strong women ready to go into, you know, female-focused strands of development strategies for all of the sports, so that women have a voice and women look after women. So, yeah, I mean, for girls in sport, it's all about fun, friends and fitness. Girls are more body conscious now, so, you know, they want to look good. You can get your body toned by doing all of the... So give them things that they're going to want to do. Don't make them do cross-country and baggy shorts and pouring rain. So yeah, the world's changed and we need to recognise that, and we need to give girls what they want.
That seems quite revolutionary to me. I've never even thought of that before in terms of giving girls extra time or extra plug sockets, and instead of trivialising what are real issues with girls and saying, well, it doesn't matter or it shouldn't matter or just get on with it, accepting it, acknowledging it and accommodating it to a certain extent.
Yeah, it is. It's you need to understand the world in which they operate, and then you need to adapt to that. You need to find a way to cater for it, otherwise it is going to be a trauma, and you are going to get girls continuing to come with notes that say, I can't do PE today because I've got a headache, signed by the mother. if you know what I mean. Yeah. You know, so yeah, it's for me, it's all wrapped up in understanding the world according to girls nowadays. And it's why I am a big believer in having more female PE teachers and having more female decision makers, because women are far more likely to understand the world according to girls, and girls are not like boys. Mm-hmm. In their physically, their bodies don't work in the same way, so you can't train them in the same way. Their bodies won't do what boys' bodies do, and their minds don't work in the same way either. And you know, it is one of the big reasons why I'm trying to work very hard to create a bigger and stronger female workforce.
Before we continue, I want to take a quick tea break to say a huge thanks to Twist Teas for supporting this podcast, because there's nothing like a chat and a cup of tea to lift the spirits. Twist Teas have a range of 24 different blends with or without caffeine. So whether you're looking for a morning pick-me-up or an afternoon soother, you're bound to find a tea to suit. You can pick from their classic blend to peppermint with a hint of chocolate, or functional herbs to give you a boost. Have a look. There really is a blend to suit pretty much every mood, or you could suggest blends of your own. Go to their website, twist-teas.co.uk. Female leaders, female role models are so important. You've said it. If you see it, you can become it. And it's something that the former world cycling champion Lizzie Deignan said to me recently as well, and that importance of having role models. Do you think we're in a better position with that these days? Are women more visible at the top of sport, or what more do we need to do about that?
I think women are a bit more visible, with no question. I think there is still a a long, long way to go. I think that what has happened over the last few years in terms of the performances of the team sports in particular, the Lionesses, England Rugby, cricket winning the Women's World Cup, the hockey, these have been great because now the performances are world class and it is watchable, it's marketable, it's sponsorable, it's visible. And you will get many more people watching it on TV or live because the performance is good enough. You know, many years ago it would be, not going to watch that, it's rubbish. But the performances are so good now. And I think that's the key to, we haven't had that problem quite in tennis because tennis has always been a global sport and the majors in tennis are covered just as well for the men as the women. And we have major stars in the Williams sisters, Sharapova, three of the biggest global superstars who happen to be tennis players, but they're instantly recognisable. And that's been great, for tennis. But I think that that whole thing of raising the levels, investing in the performance is a big thing. Because I've always said that it will always largely be women who will go and watch women's sport. And if women are going to go and watch it, it needs to be a good level. And that if it's a good level and it becomes marketable and sponsorable, and people see, you will start to create more role models who are recognisable in the way of, Jess Ennis Hill, fantastic role model for athletics and obviously for women's sport. But, you know, if you probably ask most schoolgirls to name somebody in the England women's cricket team or England women's rugby team or football team, they might not because the profiles are not so big, probably partly because it's a team sport and you become part of the team. But we should be trying to create more profiles within the individuals, within the team, so that our kids have got more athletic role models. I mean, if you're promoting sport, more athletic role models to aspire towards. And, you know, last week when I was looking at the Barbie doll of Nicola Adams that was brought out for International Women's Day, and I thought, isn't that fantastic? You know, there she is with her boxing gloves and her funky hair. And she was looking, it was great. I thought, isn't that wonderful? And when I read the backstory to it, Mattel, who make Barbie, had said that 86% of the mums that they had interviewed were unhappy with their daughter's choice of role model. And it's all reality TV and fashion and so forth. They're the ones who are in girls' spaces. You know, they're the ones who are in the magazines. They're the ones who are on the television. So we need to work harder to put other types of role model in front of our kids. And it's not, obviously, it's not just sport. There's arts and music and science. There's all sorts of things. But, you know, on the sporting side, I think we all need to work harder to promote the profiles of our female sporting stars. But those female sporting stars have to want to do it. Not everybody does. Not everybody wants the profile. But it's that whole thing. If you can see it, you can be it. You know, everybody probably knows who Jess Ennis Hill is because of the Olympics and her wonderful success. And she's a mum and she's got so many great things to talk about. And she looks fab as well as being a wonderful athlete. Yeah, we need to work harder to build more profile around more female sports stars.
It strikes me, I'm just remembering a quote that I read about Andy, actually, where I read that he was the feminist that tennis needs. Yeah. And I just wonder how you feel about that, the fact that he is quite vocal about gender parity, but also the fact that the feminist that tennis needs is a man.
Yeah, I think... I think that's unfortunate in a way that when a man speaks out on behalf of women's sport, it has so much more impact than another woman speaking out about women's sport. And, he's done a great job in lots of areas, none less than, when he started working with Amélie Mauresmo. And, it was such a... It was such an unusual thing for a sort of global sporting superstar in an individual sport to work with a female coach. And he never saw it like that. He just saw it as this is a great fit for me. You know, the way she played, her creativity, her experience as a former Grand Slam and former world number one. She had great listening skills, good personality fit, good fun. So for him, it was nothing to do with her being a woman. It was all about what she brought to the table. But the interest that it created and some of the comment that it created in a negative sense were just like hard to believe. I think he realized very early into that relationship that if he were not to do as well or better than he had been doing, she was going to get the blame for it, and it would almost be like, well, what do you expect? You know, it's all her fault. She's no good, or whatever. Anyway, it didn't work out like that, but he was really, I think, quite blown away by the negativity of certain people towards that appointment. But what it actually did was it created a lot of talk around female coaches, and it actually influenced a number of the top female players to approach ex-female players to work with them. So Lindsay Davenport went to work with Madison Keys, Navratilova had a spell with Radvanska. There was, you know, a number of instances that brought ex-women players into the game to work with women, and that was great. But he's used to kind of all his formative tennis years, I guess. He was always used to me being around, and so for him, he's always found it easy to talk to women, and he's never thought of it as being anything, you know, it's a men's male domain or anything like that. So that helps a lot when he speaks out about that. So good for him.
And that apparent, at least, gender blindness, whether you like it or not, is a credit to you and how you have blazed a trail over the years. You've talked about the sexism that you've had to deal with. How do you feel the female landscape is at the moment, if you like? Do you think that sexism is still as much of a problem or as much of an obstacle to women succeeding in any way, or is it just more subtle now?
I think there's definitely, there's been a lot of movement in the right direction. There's no question about that. I think we still have a long way to go. I think, you know, certainly in sport, the most recent thing that came out was all the sports having to declare their gender pay gaps. And, you know, it was very clear, you know, I obviously looked at tennis, and you know, it was very clear that the LTA, who have about 300 employees, and it's roughly a 50-50 split, but the gender pay gap was something like 55%, which is huge, which basically means that all the top jobs are with men. So, like, I would know that anyway, but when you actually see it like that, you think, wow, you know, there still is, and it's not something you'll reverse overnight. You know, there has to be a directive from the top, and there needs to be an investment in a, you know, in a career pathway. And if I look at something like tennis coaching, there are hardly any jobs, salaried jobs, in tennis coaching. Nearly everything is self-employed. So if you're a young person thinking about, I'd like to be a tennis coach, there isn't really any job security, because you can't go and get a, I don't know, 20 grand a year salary and be employed by somebody. It just doesn't happen like that. You actually have to build your own business. So it's not like a really attractive career for young people. So if we want to try and get more women delivering, we have to create a career pathway, and we probably need to put on some seminars along with our coaching qualifications about how to run your own business, how to do your own accounts, all of these kind of things, and make it much more attractive to, you know, to more women. So yeah, I think there is a bit of groundswell, and has been for a few years in different ways, on the performances, on the visibility. But I think we all have to stick together, the women, and we have to work together, and we have to use our voices wherever we can to influence change while there is a groundswell. We can't let it slide. No.
Judy, you're so active in promoting all of this, and so devoted to pushing sport for children, for girls. It seems to me that you're an incredibly busy woman. What do you do to switch off? How do you take time to yourself?
Well, I actually liked I like doing quite normal things. You know, I like going to musicals. I like going out with my friends for lunch and for dinner. I enjoy doing things like that and just talking. I like going to the spa. I don't go very often, but I really enjoy it when I can. I like working, though. I like being busy. I like being active. I like feeling like I'm being effective. I get bored quite easily. I think another couple of years, I think, you know, and then I'll be 60, and then I'll be thinking, right, I think I've done my bit now. I think somebody else. But I think that, you know, that the women's side is my thing at the moment. And I think if you, you know, I created this program with the LTA called She Rallies, and we launched it last February. And basically we kicked it off with a women's coaching conference, first of its kind, in the UK. And it was a networking opportunity. We had 7 female speakers. We brought all the women coaches together. We created something that was just for them. Great fun, great buzz in the room. And then we took on 26 part-time ambassadors. So it was giving 26 women, just very small retainers, but it was giving them responsibility, sense of belonging, part of something altogether. But it was a part of an empowerment. This is a thing that is just for women, and it's all about the girl thing. And 8 months later, we took on another 36 ambassadors. So I trained the first 26, and then we took on another 30. So we have 56 altogether now. So that's 56 women who now have a role. They're very small roles, but it doesn't matter, because for some of them, they can only take on a small role because they've got families. But it's creating a piece of, they're part of something, and it's a women's movement, that's a women's army or whatever. And the idea is that those ambassadors go out into their patches and they train up others in their area the way that I trained them. And these people that they train up, they could be other coaches, but for the most part, they are teachers, mums, club members, students, fifth and sixth year pupils at school who might consider helping out at their local club or perhaps going into coaching or perhaps running a competition or running a fun day. We train them how to do all of those things so that it's a bit pyramid effect, you know, a sort of snowball. So we start to grow that. So I'm in the second year of 3. That is a 3-year project for me. But my goal at the end of the 3 years is to be able to step away with an army in there and some people who can step into my shoes. Maybe not just one person, maybe 5 or 6 people who can do what I've been doing in different parts of the country and keep it all moving. But I reckon by the time I'm 60, I should just be able to switch off and be a granny.
Do you really think you'll be able to? Do you really think you'll get to 60? And I love, by the way, it'll take 5 or 6 people to step into your shoes. That says so much.
I probably said that wrong.
No, I know what you mean.
The country's too big for one person. That was really more what I meant.
But do you think you will get to the age of 60 and be able to say to yourself, yeah, I'm just going to take it easy now? I'm doubting that somehow.
I know. I might not last till 60, of course, but assuming I do, yeah, I think I find it difficult to step away altogether. But, you know, I have I'm designing at the moment a tennis centre in Scotland, just outside of Dunblane where we live. And that's been a very long-term dream and goal of mine, to have a base to work from. And that's kind of really what I want to do is, you know, I've been coaching for about 30 years now, and I've experienced coaching from, you know, volunteer right up to the top end of the game and every step in between. So I want to be able to share that knowledge, but I want people to be able to come to me and see examples of best practice, see great sessions in action. But from a base, so I'm not having to hear around the country all the time. So that's really my final piece of my jigsaw. So in 2 years' time, that'll be up and running, and I'll have my army, I'll be ready to take over the rest of the tennis world.
But Judy, best of luck easing into retirement. I think you might need it.
I think I might as well.
I have to admit that despite having interviewed some of the top athletes and sporting figures in the world, I was really nervous about meeting Judy Murray. Maybe excited is a better word, I'm not sure, but I'm truly in awe of the sacrifices she made continuously for her boys. Any parent will say they want the best for their child, but Judy's memoir reads like a reality check almost of what that actually means in practice. The memoir, incidentally, is called Knowing the Score, and I'd highly recommend it. It's a great read. To keep her dignity and composure as well during those years when the media mocked and attacked her speaks of a strength of character, I think, that any girl or boy in the age of social media can take inspiration from. Men and women too, actually, for that matter. And speaking of female role models, in the next episode of When Orla Met...
Next minute we come back to England and we were of interest, we were on the front pages of all the newspapers, which have never put women's sport on the front pages. 11 years of my life was basically preparing to fail. and then only literally on the day before I finished did we win.
When Orla Met, Maggie Alfonsi is up next. Thanks as ever to Jonathan Rowe for editing this episode, and a huge thank you to Twist Teas for sponsoring this podcast and for making truly delicious different teas to boot. If you've any thoughts on what you've heard so far, do get in touch via email orla@whenorlamet.com. You can leave comments and follow me on Twitter and Instagram @whenorlamet. And if you like what you hear, please do leave me a review on iTunes. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to not miss out on any of the chats still to come. Please do subscribe to When Orla Met.